Welcome to the Society of Armenian Studies podcast. My name is David Gutman. I am Associate Professor of History at Manhattanville College in New York. And I have the pleasure today of speaking with Professor Hans-Lukas Kieser, who is Associate Professor of History at the University of Newcastle in Australia, as well as future Fellow of the Australian Research Council. Additionally, he is an honorary professor at the University of Zurich in Switzerland. He has, in addition to his academic position between 2006 and 2015, he was also the president of the Research Foundation, now Research Association Switzerland Turkey. In addition, he has taught at a number of institutions internationally, including Stanford University and the University of Michigan in the United States, Bilgi University in Istanbul, the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris, and he is the author of several books in both German and English, including Der Verpasste Friede, Vorkämpfe der Neuen Türkei, A Quest for Belonging, and Nearest East, American Millennialism and Mission to the Middle East. The first two works in German are also available in Turkish translation. But today we are going to be talking about his newest work, published this year, 2018, by Princeton University Press. It is titled Talat Pasha, Father of Modern Turkey, Architect of Genocide. So welcome to the podcast, Professor Kieser.
Yeah, hello, David. Thanks for having me today.
Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to what should be a very enjoyable discussion. And let's jump right into some of the questions. Talat Pasha is, which this book is a biography of Talat Pasha, who was Minister of Interior during the World War I era. He's hardly an obscure figure, especially to scholars of the late Ottoman Empire, World War I, and the Armenian Genocide. He is known to many for, in part, for the way that he died. He was assassinated in Berlin in 1921 by an Armenian assassin who was tasked with assassinating Talat Pasha as a way of seeking justice for his pivotal role in the Armenian genocide. But more broadly, this isn't just a biography of Talat Pasha, but it is also using him, his figure, as a lens to explore various questions in terms of late Ottoman history, the history of the Armenian genocide, the Ottoman role in World War I, but more broadly, the world historical significance of the Ottoman role in World War I, as well as the the kind of political philosophies that were emerging in the Ottoman Empire at this time that were influencing developments elsewhere in the world. But this book, in a sense, overturns a certain standard historiographical narrative, which tends to view the Ottoman Empire, especially after the 1913 coup that brought the CUP, the Committee of Union in Progress, to full power in the Ottoman Empire, as the Ottoman Empire in World War I being led by this triumvirate of Talat Pasha, Enver Pasha, and Cemal Pasha. You challenge this kind of standard narrative by focusing specifically on the central importance of Talat Pasha. So do you mind explaining why is Talat Pasha so especially pivotal in understanding this historical period?
Yeah, Talat Pasha was, of course, not totally outstanding or super elevated dictator as the dictators that we know from the years after him in the history of larger Europe. But this might to a certain extent explain why one remained in a way stuck to this picture of a triumvirate during the whole 1910s. Whereas we can justly use this notion only for the eve of the First World War, that is 1913, the first half or whole of 1914. But the difference or the distinction that we must do if we look precisely is to see that only Talat stood really both in the party and also in the government in a top position. So he was the only one who could really fully profit from this dual position, which was, of course, due to the situation of a single party regime. And he was the one who was most in the capital, so he could really hold together the connections, and he could also cultivate and develop the different connections, both within the party, in the government, with the international diplomats who were present. This makes him very clearly, if one looks more closely at the political biography or political biographies now compared to the others, makes him clearly the strongest one. And this is something that is also, one can note it, especially in the German diplomatic correspondence. But because Enver Pasha was the darling of the German press and of the German court as well, especially in the years before the First World War, and still in the first year, let's say, of the First World War, he appears in German sources as someone very special, and Talat in a way disappears behind him. But which is tricky, which is not true if one then analyzes the diplomatic correspondence. One sees very clearly that Talat has the main say, and it becomes very explicit in the second half of the First World War that the German diplomats see Enver as a weak political figure in comparison to Talat, whom they see as the main pillar. So that's one, let's say, main argument, a general argument. And then if you look at some sources that have become accessible very recently only, that is the full diaries of Mehmet Javid Bey, the finance minister and close collaborator, but also another CUP and Central Committee member, the Sheikh Ul-Islam Mustafa Hayri Urgut Bleu. And if one reads these diary entries, then one sees also clearly, one gets several elements that show clearly that Talat was the man who planned, the man who had the last word. And so this is a second, let's say, element from the close, seen from the close interactions within the committee. And then a third element, of course, is a kind of a scrutiny of the politics themselves from the Ottoman State Archives and from an overall let's say assessment of the politics. Then again, it is Talat who, both in foreign policy and of course most of foremost in the domestic policy, was absolutely seminal and predominant. And so this makes him clearly outstanding, in one word.
Well, and I think this is a nice point to segue into a related question, which is, I think that your book adds to this growing, if still somewhat nascent, literature that looks at the post-1908 period as in a sense, a kind of tragic period that starts out in 1908 with the 1908 revolution, with this great hope for a perhaps more democratic or constitutional future for the Ottoman Empire, and ends with the with the horrific tragedy of World War I and the Armenian genocide that seems just the mere opposite of this hope for a more open future in 1908. And this kind of trajectory is mirrored in Talat's own thought and his own political evolution in this period. So could you talk a little bit more about that, how his politics evolves between 1908 and the outbreak of World War I?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right that Talat is a very interesting mirror for this road from hope to darkness.
Mm-hmm.
So my book is my biography is not linear, not determinist. On the contrary, I emphasize that Talat, in contrast to others, the so-called Eminence Crise, Dr. Nazem, Dr. Shakir in the Central Committee, was a comparatively open-minded, even, let's say, democratic-minded, as a comparatively democratic-minded young politician in 1908, 1909, who really wanted to go on with parliamentary politics, with transparent public politics, and not necessarily continue the secret politics as the committee, of course, was used to do since its underground. And what others also wanted to continue to hold on with their own power. So Talat, the problem is, nevertheless, one must say this right from the start, that the primary goal was not constitutional government. And the constitutional Turkey or the constitutional Ottoman Empire, a constitution, an Ottoman world, but the primary goal was to make Turkey great again, or to re-empower the state, save the state, as ran the world at that time, the catchword. And power, and this is therefore the very important notion of the imperial bias throughout my whole book. And which I do not only use for the Ottoman case. So it was not first about building up a constitutional Turkey, but it was first about re-empowering Turkey. And this is then unfortunately, I must say, I would have loved to write another biography. This is also the case with Talat. Mm-hmm. And this makes him then do a turn, which my biography describes a real turn in his political life, 1911, 1912, then very visibly in late 1912, when he turns a radical, a warmonger, and also an authoritarian. And this visible turn then of who starts after the coup, the anti-CUP coup in July 1912, which is temporarily successful, and which could have resulted in the very end of the CUP, but as we all know, it ended then in the CUP putsch or coup of January 1913 and the establishment of the CUP single rule. So this very visible period in which another Talat, to a certain extent another Talat, emerges is preceded by a longer period of crisis that we can describe for, let's say, 2 years or so. It's also linked to a personal crisis. Talat is taught by his personal doctor that he's unable to father a child. And this was, of course, a deep problem for his fresh marriage. So I do not overemphasize this point. I just also mention it as part of this whole picture. in which Talat then appears as a radical, as one who once war at all price against the Balkan states, which themselves wanted war as well. Of course, but generally one emphasizes only this side and not the side of the CUP and the role of the CUP in calling for war in autumn 1912. And a very important point, and I would also say a very important argument in this book, is to say that in the same period, also 1912, 1913, it is the emergence, the coming out of Zia Gökalp as the ideologue of the CUP, with its pan-Turkism, which possesses a very strong force of mobilization for the whole elite. And a main argument of the book is to show Talat and Gökalp as a kind of twins, one the executive and the other the prophet of the regime, the ideologue, the writer, the mastermind. And as we all know, as scholars, we all know that Zia Gökalp, until now, he's the spiritual father of Turkish nationalism. And he's really, really a main figure in the history of ideas of modern Turkey. And only what lacked and still lacks to a certain extent is an in-depth analysis of Gökalp in the 1910s. I have done it as much as it was necessary to shed light on Talat. But I re-emphasize, I repeat, we must see both together. And both were in the Central Committee, and both played a very important role, and both stood in a synergy. And only this synergy was able to develop the power that, in fact, was the reality in Talat's reign.
And that's what I find, again, also quite fascinating with the book, is that we see Zia Gökalp coming in at this moment of crisis and really clearly radicalizing Talat. So there's a certain dark serendipity there in which we find both Talat and the empire itself plunged into this crisis. And it's Zia Gökalp's sort of millenarian view of the Ottoman future that really shapes and helps to radicalize Talat. I want, because this is, of course, the Society of Armenian Studies podcast, and this is also a central aspect of the book also, is how do you envision in the book Talat's role in the Armenian genocide?
Yeah, let's come from this point. Also, Talat sacrifices constitutionalism from late 1912, step by step, for what I call the political messianism of Zia Gökalp, which has a very strong pan-Turkist aspect, but is also a Turkish vision, a Turkish nationalist vision of Asia Minor, which is the aspect that remains. The pan-Turkist territorial aspect, of course, was not fulfilled, whereas the Turkish aspect regarding Anatolia was fulfilled, has become reality, but was part of one whole, which I repeat was the abandonment of the constitutionalism of 1908 and the embrace of a political messianism, which as an exuberant messianism, but that's normally the case with political messianisms, which really exalted the Turkish nation and also the Turkish race. But in that time, together with Islam, this was strongly linked during the whole 1910s. And this is, of course, now not the whole explanation for the Armenian genocide, but it is a very important framework and one that often has been neglected There was the strong vision of Talat as a poor pragmatist of the whole committee, as just reacting and working for the security of the empire, not at all ideologically, but just playing with ideological elements in order to mobilize or to hold together the endangered empire. And so my revision of this is that we must see Talat also as a clearly ideological figure at the side of Ziya Gökalp. And without this, we do not come to a coherent picture of the Ottoman 1910s. We lack if we do not see these features, the analytical power, the analytical insights to explain the Ottoman history of the 1910s, including its impact on a whole century until today. Ziya Gökalp is still very strong, and the political messianism, which is linked to him, has not died at all. So this is already very important, because this meant giving up the Armenians as the partners of an effort toward constitutional Turkey. So it's fundamentally important to see this turning point of the late 1912. It was at the same time the divorce between Armenians and the CUP. Even if now in reality and pragmatically there were still relations, but fundamentally it was the separation. The Armenians only had a chance of survival in the Ottoman Empire if it was based on a constitutional base, and so this turn was dramatic in this sense, I must stop here at the inflow of emails that disrupted me. Can you cut?
Yes.
Yeah, also the separation between Armenian and CUP goals, as they clearly started to be reality from 1912, is of course a precondition of the possibility of genocide. Still, genocide or a very harsh policy against the Armenians, if we put it more generally, would not have become reality without the World War I. So still, the reform agreement of February 1914 would have been strong enough, together with European diplomacy, if the July crisis and the World War I would not have come a few months later. So Talat's role, therefore, in regard of the genocide, starts after August 1914. And what I said with regard to his term is die Bedingung der Möglichkeit, is the condition for the possibility of a very radical policy, which is present since 1912 in his political figure, in his political mind, but not reality. So it becomes much more concrete, and we see it as with the outbreak of World War I, in which we must again see Talat and his close circle, together with Enver, with Halil, and Gökalp also, as proactive. So they proactively sought the alliance with Germany and Austria. It was them, not the other side, who wanted at any price this alliance and who in a way had embraced war since, as I said, autumn 1912 as a very important means to get power and to hold on this power position and expand power. And that's at that time, and we see in the publications of Gökalp of August 1914, linked to high expectations of a Turkey becoming Turan, thus expanding, and a Russia that would collapse. Now, more concretely, Talat. We see Talat in early September 1914 already ordering the governors to closely survey all Armenian leaders. So we see that he makes some concrete steps, which do not yet mean, of course, what then happened a half a year later, but which were steps towards what he then implemented half a year later. So what happened in the half year between these first steps of a rigid control of the Armenians after they had disagreed with the CUP proposal to build up a guerrilla, an anti-Russian guerrilla in the Caucasus. So that was already a caesura of early August 1914. So what happens is, of course, the total frustration of the pan-Turkist expansion that was so important in Gökalp's expectations just already in August 1914. Then it is the partial, this catastrophic defeat against the Russian army at Sarikamish in the Caucasus. It's the partial entrance of the Russian army on Ottoman territory, especially in the region of Van. So it's the specter of a Russian presence together with Armenians who would then come in power. So exactly the contrary of what they expected. And this goes on, and depression, a real depression, also psychological and political, in the capital goes on until February 1915. And it's only the first victory against the attempt at the naval entrance through the Bosporus to the capital that gives then the CUP leaders, Talat, Enver, and the others a real punch, in the sense that they think, we can nevertheless turn the situation to our favor. And the important thing here is to see that for them, the First World War was not only about the fronts, the military fronts against the outside, but the exterior, but the foreign powers, but it was absolutely also about the complete change, revolutionary change within the Ottoman realm in a Turkish understanding, making Anatolia a Turkish national home, a Türkürdü, as around the notion. And so we see a re-empowered or revitalized CUP Central Committee from this first victory on the 18th of March. And meetings that happened then together with leaders coming back from the Eastern Front, Bahattin Shakir, leader of the special organization and a very important Central Committee member, a hardliner. And we see then also come letters, telegrams written by governors, the young governors, the cadre of Talat. He really had his cadre, and the cadre that went then also on over to Kemal Atatürk after the First World War, and went on serving him for decades, or Turkey, still after Atatürk's death. So these young men, part of them in the eastern provinces, helped, contributed to radicalizing, or let's say to implementing radical solutions in Talat's mind. Late March, early April 1915, so that Talat then finally decided exactly in the same for the same night in which the Entente forces landed, the ANZAC forces landed in Gallipoli, he decided to implement his strike, his comprehensive strike against the Armenian elite that would lead then to the Armenian genocide a few weeks later. Yeah, so we see him, as I said, very decisive in his control starting in early September, in his mirroring the whole situation with the personal depression that he has, and then in a way again reinventing or retrieving himself and the committee as he did in late 1912 with radical politics. And these radical politics would not have been possible without the victory, the very strongly German also sponsored or led victories, several victories at Gallipoli and the Dardanelles. Yeah, so that put very shortly for the genesis, and then the whole management of the Armenian genocide is even more, much more clearly Talat's work, because he was the guy who gave all the specific orders, well-timed, one province after the other, for the first phase of the Armenian genocide, so really evacuating what should be the Türk-Kürdü, whole of Asia Minor. So this was absolutely under his order. And even the second phase of the genocide, that is the survivors in northern Syria, in the camps, contemporarily called the concentration camps, it's his cadre who runs this camp, not Cemal Pasha's. Cemal Pasha is the governor of Greater Syria. So we see him in both phases, and especially, of course, in the first decisive phase as the real leader of the policy, and when I say this, I do not again not make him an absolute figure who is abstracted from the other, who is super elevated, but again I repeat, he was like a hub of power. So he took in the inspiration, the suggestions. He was the guy who balanced the different reactions coming from the diplomats. He was the guy who stopped Cemal Pasha when Cemal Pasha wanted to be radical in Palestine too. He was the guy who understood that he could not afford another scandal, but he wanted to concentrate on the Armenians. So he was the leader, but in the sense of a hub. He took all the different connections and forces and made his decision out of all these elements that came to him and were influential. So other elements and other persons were influential, to put it otherwise, yeah.
Well, I think in the few minutes we have remaining, again, I think this is a great seed to think about Talat's significance both for modern Turkey, but also for political developments in Europe and globally in the 20th century. You very, I think, provocatively subtitle the book. You refer to him as the father of modern Turkey, which in a sense takes that title away from Mustafa Kemal. So perhaps you could talk very briefly about Talat's significance for the birth of the modern Turkish Republic, but again, also for the emergence of what you call sort of the era of European dictators, the 20th century nationalism that would become kind of the political language of the post-World War I era.
Yes, let's start with this one first. So with the establishment of the single party regime in 1913, we have for the first time a true single party regime reigning an empire, So that's already a political premiere for the 20th century. And at the same time, this is a regime that is totally revanchist because of the First Balkan War, so which plans a huge demographic engineering in nationalist terms, but again, imperially biased, because a main argument for me is to say, all these radical violence would not have happened without the imperial bias. It would not have happened if they had concentrated, let's say, on the construction of a Türk-Kürdo in a constitutional sense, together with the Armenians, together with the others, still a Türk-Kürdo, but a constitutional Türk-Kürdo, a constitutional Turkey. So it's very important. So the contrary is the case. It is deeply imperially biased. It's radical. It's brutal. It's a brutal, energetic style that the German propaganda called it energetic, and they hold on with saying this. I see this as deeply toxic, politically toxic for Germany. So my book is about Germany as well, very strongly. And I would say that this CUP single party regime opens the Europe of the dictatorships, the genocides, and the demographic engineering, or the extremes, to quote another notion, the Europe of the extremes. It's the single party rule of the CUP, and we must look at the Ottoman capital also, not exclusively, but also for the outbreak of the First World War. What has not been done, even not by Christopher Clark, which rightly took us more to the Balkan, but the Balkans is not enough. It's one important step to look at Belgrade and other places with their political, let's say, culture of more radical in comparison to contemporary continental Europe, if we make a section of the colonies, of course. For the outbreak of the First World War, we have to fully take into consideration also the proactive politics in Istanbul. So far, very shortly, for the global historical impact and weight of this new style of politics. And German authors did not hesitate to call it again a new style, and impressive style, and energetic style of politics that many of them took as a model, especially because it was linked to war propaganda. So they looked away, they turned a blind eye to all the dark aspects. Now back to the question of father of modern Turkey, of course not alone. Atatürk still is a father, so I do not say, I say father, not the father. So one might also say a forefather, or at least a co-founder of modern Turkey. It's because of the Türk-Kürdo, because of the national home Anatolia. So that's the part of, that's the war goal, the minimal war goal, so to say, which was really implemented despite defeat in World War I, despite the end of the empire, despite the defeat of the Imperial War. This important war goal since 1913, that is making Anatolia a Turkish national home, a Turkish sovereignty, a unitary state, this was implemented. Not by Talat fully, because only Mustafa Kemal then, after the wars, after he had won with his forces the war for Anatolia in 1919 to 1922, and then the revolutionary changes, he implemented it. But Talat, without Talat, he would not have been able to do it, because demographically Talat already prepared such a unitary Turkish home, And he prepared it in economical terms because it was the dispossession of the non-Muslims. And he prepared it also on several other levels, cultural level, legal level. So we see several steps that Atatürk took in a fully radical manner then in the interwar period, already taken to a certain extent by Talat. Let's mention the civil law reform. Let's mention the new names for places, for towns. Let's mention also the interdiction of certain languages, especially Armenian. Talat is very clearly the man, the ruler, the strong man who prepares in a first foundational phase modern Turkey in the sense of a unitary nationalist, radically nationalist state.
Well, on that note, Professor Keyser, this has been a fascinating discussion that hopefully spurs people to read the book in its entirety. And I certainly hope that this book becomes not only required reading for students of the late Ottoman Empire, of the Ottoman role in World War I, but really read by historians with a global interest, and to think about the central role that the Ottoman Empire played, not only in World War I, but also in shaping these critical political developments of the 20th century. So thank you very much for speaking with us today.
I thank you too, David, for the conversation. You're very welcome.
All right. Thank you.